Possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, celebrating cultural diversity with the artists of the Fez Festival of Sacred Music on March 30th and 31st, and Santur virtuoso Manocher Sadi on April 1st. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Happy St. Patrick's Day. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program today, who was St. Patrick? Ireland's patron saint has been shrouded in legend. You know the stories. Patrick drove the snakes out of Ireland, battled pagan druids, used a shamrock to explain the Trinity, and converted the population to Christianity. Is any of it true? Well, we'll sort things out this afternoon with Philip Freeman. He's a professor of classics at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Freeman has written a biography of Patrick called St. Patrick of Ireland. The story Philip Freeman tells in this biography is a good one, so stay tuned and join the discussion. I invite your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Philip Freeman's previous books include War, Women, and Druids, and Ireland, and the Classical World. His new book, St. Patrick of Ireland, is published by Simon & Schuster. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Freeman, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So the stories I mentioned, none is true.
Well, none is completely true, at least. The snake story is not true, and the shamrock story we have no evidence for. And the fact that he converted all of Ireland is a bit of an overstatement.
Right. It seems, though, that he did have some run-ins, perhaps, with druids and with kings.
Oh, certainly. He had some difficult times. Ireland, back in the days of St. Patrick in the 5th century, was divided into about 150 independent and often warring kingdoms. So it was a tough place to operate, and Patrick had to be very careful and very savvy about how he did it. And he did run into pretty much constant trouble for several decades.
Mm. His story is really pretty amazing, and so is learning what life in that part of the world was like 15 centuries ago. St. Patrick lived long ago. The date of his birth is at the end of the 4th century. Tell us how you were able to get at Patrick's true story.
Well, the best thing about Patrick is that he left us two letters, which he wrote himself as an old man. He wrote these in Latin, of course. That was the language of a Roman, such as Patrick was. That is the prime evidence for the story of Patrick. But also there's other evidence, archaeology, contemporary Greek and Roman historians, and especially Irish evidence, like Irish law, written down in the Middle Ages, which looks back at this early period.
Hmm. You include translations of Patrick's letters in the book. How was it that these letters managed to survive, and how do we know they're authentic?
Well, it is amazing that they managed to survive. Patrick wrote them, maybe in the 460s, best guess. And the earliest copy of the letters which we have, which is only a part of one letter, comes from about the year 807. So what we have is a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. So much was lost of classical literature. It's just amazing and wonderful that these survived. How we know they're authentic? Well, there are linguistic arguments that you can make, dating the Latin and things like that. But I think the best argument is, just by reading them, you get a picture of a man which is unlike any other saint's life at the time. There were always lives of saints being written, and the saints are always doing miracles.
Mm-hmm.
But the subject matter of these letters gives you a very human person. There wouldn't be any reason for anyone to forge letters like this.
Yeah, he was a very human person. He had his faults and his good points.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to his beginnings. He was born a Roman citizen in Britain, the son of a nobleman. named Calpurnius.
Yes.
What can you tell us about his father and other family members?
Well, Patrick, as you said, was born as a Roman, and if you had asked Patrick who he was, that's any time during his life, that's what he would have said: "I am a Roman." He was very proud of it. He was born into the nobility, the Roman nobility in the province of Britain. His ancestors were probably Celtic Britons, but they had been Romanized for several centuries by the time Patrick was born. He was born into a Christian family. His grandfather was a priest. His father was a deacon, which is a slightly lesser office in the church. And he was raised in a state of great wealth, or at least of modest wealth. The family had a home in town in Beneventa Berniae, and they also had a country estate or a villa out several miles out of town.
Now, would Christians today recognize the religious practices of Calpurnius and his family?
You know, I think they would. It's the Christianity of Patrick's time, I guess you could say, was not fully formed yet. It certainly it wouldn't be fair to call Patrick a Catholic in the modern sense. It was really before those sorts of beliefs were solidified. But I think they would. And you can look in Patrick's second letter, what he calls his confession, which is really more of a defense. And in that letter, at the beginning of it, he gives a creed of what he believes. And anybody who goes to a Christian church and recites the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed would look at this and say, yes, this is pretty much exactly what we say every Sunday. So I think Christians today would recognize Patrick's brand of Christianity.
Yeah. Now, would there have been readings from Scripture? Would there have been singing of hymns?
Oh, yes, that was a part of it. There would be reading from the different parts of the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament. There would be psalms. The Book of Psalms in the Old Testament were a favorite. And then there were other songs as well that had been developed. There would have been a sermon, and very often there would have been communion or a Eucharist.
Hmm. And church architecture, ornate or simple? Was there a crucifix in the building?
Well, you know, it was actually very simple. At least the evidence that we have from Britain anyway, there's not a whole lot of it, to be honest, is that the churches were laid out in a fairly simple manner. In Ireland, Patrick's churches, he may not have been able to construct anything fancy at all. It may have been a converted barn, for all we know, or even outside under a tree when
mm-hmm.
it wasn't raining.
Yeah. Now, what kind of an education would Patrick have had? He came from a well-to-do family, so he had some kind of education.
Yes, he would have had a very good education, actually. His native tongue, what they spoke at home and spoke with the servants, was probably British, which is an ancestor of modern Welsh. But he would have learned Latin from the earliest days. He would have gone to school, starting at about the same time people go to school now, about 5 or 6. And for several years, he would have had the equivalency of elementary school. He would have learned basic letters, reading, writing, mathematics. Then he would have moved on to a more advanced stage, the equivalent of junior high school or middle school, where he got more deeply into literature and memorizing great passages of Virgil's Aeneid and other bits of classical literature. And then most people would have moved on to a final stage, a polishing stage, where they learned rhetoric, which was very important in the ancient world, the art of public speaking. But Patrick missed these mm-hmm. phase of his training.
Yeah. Well, before we get to that part of the story, let's continue to talk a little bit about languages. This was very interesting to me. A person like Patrick would have spoken more than one language, British and Latin. How important was Latin?
Well, Latin was very important to anybody in Patrick's class, anybody in his social standing. They had to know Latin. It was the language of the government. It was the language of all of the army. It was anything official was done in Latin. We'd have maybe 2 very small bits of evidence of written British. It was not a written language. So Latin was essential.
Yeah. And the stories that he was told as a boy, this was fun to discover.
Yeah.
Again, some things that we are very familiar with.
Oh, yes. We have stories, all the Aesop's fables, the country mouse and the city mouse, all the stories that come from the Greek and Roman sources Patrick would have known. Plus, he probably would have been told stories that come from Celtic sources. such as survive in later medieval Welsh literature.
Hmm. While Patrick's family was Christian, he rejected the faith.
He did.
As a kid.
Yes, he did. He says that he was an atheist from childhood.
Yeah, of course. Obviously, he came to believe.
He did. It took the hardship, though, of slavery before that happened.
Yeah. But as a young man at 15, he was not interested at all in the faith, and he apparently also got into some trouble at that age.
He did. He says that when he was 15 years old, he committed a sin which was so serious, and he never names this. It's so frustrating. He says he committed a sin which he felt so guilty about that he had to confess later on when he was in his 20s. He told it to a friend. And then when he was an old man in his 70s or 80s, he got in trouble again because this sin was discovered by certain church officials who used it as a pretext to bring Patrick up on charges. So it must have been something, it was more than just stealing fruit off a tree. It was something quite serious.
Very egregious. What could it have been?
Well, in early Christian literature, the three types of sin which come up again and again as the most serious ones are sexual immorality, idolatry, that is, participating in some non-Christian ceremony, or murder. So really, it pretty much is narrowed down to those three. Sexual immorality, I don't know, it's hard to believe. Here's a 15-year-old, he has some sort of a fling, and here he is as an old man getting in trouble for it. I don't know, that even the most prudish people I don't think would do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would narrow it down more towards some sort of idolatry, or possibly even murder. It could be done.
Yeah. Well, idolatry at 15, given that he was an atheist at this point, one wonders how serious a sin that would have been.
Well, he was an atheist, but he's like a lot of, I think he was like a lot of teenagers, especially teenagers, say, of ministers. They get very rebellious, and he probably kept up the outward form of Christianity. And he all he had to do, if he really wanted to annoy his parents, as many 15-year-olds do, as I certainly did, was to participate in some sort of a ceremony to the god Jupiter or Mercury or Lugos or you name it. There were a lot of different temples there in the area in Britain, and that would have been considered quite serious because he was considered to be a Christian.
Hmm. And the practices within these kind of pagan temples, would they have been considered immoral?
Well, you know, they wouldn't have been shocking, I don't think. Well, some of them might have been, actually. There would have been sacrifices of different animals to the gods, but there were some religions, such as the god Mithras, where you bathed in the blood of a bull which had been just slaughtered. So that sort of thing certainly would have, it wouldn't have been a surprise to Patrick's parents, but it would have been enough to scandalize them, I think.
Hmm. We're talking this afternoon about St. Patrick. Who was St. Patrick? Ireland's patron saint is the topic here this afternoon here in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is Philip Freeman. He's a professor of classics at Washington University in St. Louis. And Professor Freeman has written a biography of Patrick called St. Patrick of Ireland. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, now we come to a very dramatic part of the story. This part of the story sets Patrick on course for coming back to his faith, coming back to Christianity. At 15 years of age, he's kidnapped from his family.
Yes. So he says that sometime just before his 16th birthday, he was out at the family villa. Apparently his mom and dad weren't there. And he was kidnapped, taken by Irish pirates, by Irish slave raiders, who came in, took the people who they thought that they could sell back in Ireland, and killed the ones that they couldn't. So Patrick was hauled off along with all of the family servants and slaves and anybody else around who they thought was valuable. He was shackled. Irons were put around his neck. He was marched off to a boat, thrown in the boat, and taken back across the Irish Sea to Ireland.
Was this kind of thing common?
Well, actually, it happened a good bit in the classical world. Even from the time of Homer in about 700 B.C., there are frequent stories of people being taken as slaves. So yes, it was. It didn't happen every day, but it was the sort of thing which Patrick would have heard stories about growing up. So he would have known about it, yeah.
Yeah. And slavery was, as you mentioned, a fact of life in Britain. You mentioned that Patrick's family had slaves, and they might have been the servants and slaves rounded up with Patrick.
Oh, absolutely. Slavery was everywhere in the Greek and Roman world, and it was a rare voice who raised any objection to it. It was assumed to be a perfectly normal thing, even with Christians. It comes up in the New Testament. Slaves are urged to obey their masters. The Apostle Paul never urges slaves to revolt. It was just taken as an unfortunate but normal part of life.
Now, did Patrick's view of slavery change as a result of being a slave?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In his letters, he writes of his deep concern, especially for the women of Ireland, and he particularly talks about the women slaves, because the women there, excuse me, who were slaves in Ireland, had no rights at all, and they were subject to all kinds of horrible abuse. And he does express a great concern for them, but he never comes out and says, slavery is wrong, slavery is bad. So I don't know if he had any great change of heart about the institution itself, or he just developed a particular concern for the women who were enslaved.
Hmm. Slavery in Ireland was apparently more brutal than it was in Britain. What can you tell us about the lives of slaves in Britain and in Ireland?
Well, under Roman rule, which included Britain, slavery, well, it wasn't pleasant by any means, but a slave could at least look forward to, if he or she worked hard, they could save enough money and buy their way out of slavery. And slavery in the Roman world was never based on race. It was persons of any ethnic origin could be slaves. In Ireland, it was a little bit different, and it was certainly more harsh. An Irish slave, by Irish law, couldn't be freed, or if he was freed, it was considered that this would be a disruption to the natural order. Bad things would happen. Cows would stop giving milk and things like that. So a slave in Ireland had absolutely nothing to look forward to except a life of servitude.
Mm-hmm. Patrick was in Ireland as a slave for 6 years, tending sheep, and at this time he begins to find his faith. When and why did the idea of God begin to appeal to him?
Well, we can only speculate, but Patrick says that while he was a slave, and while he talks about being there and suffering day after day, night after night, in the cold and the wind and the snow and the frost, he had lost everything. So he turned to the one thing which he still possessed, which he still had taken with him from Britain, which was deep inside of him, this Christian faith. And adversity has a wonderful way of focusing the mind, and I think that's what happened to Patrick. He looked for comfort, and the only comfort he could find was in the childhood stories, which he had heard from his Christian parents. So he has a religious awakening, which is gradual, but very, very real.
Yeah. And he begins to pray and fast. And this must have appeared very strange, you know, to the Irish.
Well, it did. As best we can tell, pre-Christian Irish religion involved sacrifice. That was the main thing, just like Greek and Roman religion. And there must have been prayers. There were prayers in Greek and Roman religion. But Patrick says he prayed 100 times during the day and as many times during the night. And that would have seemed strange to anybody in Ireland, that they would pray this much. And fasting. Fasting was something which would have been considered by the Irish to be a very odd religious act. There was fasting in Ireland, but it was considered, something you did if somebody did wrong to you. What you would do is you go and sit in front of their door, and you would fast until they were shamed into setting things right. So for Patrick to pray constantly, for him to fast as a means of worship, was totally foreign to the Irish.
Hmm. After 6 years, he manages to escape his situation in slavery. How does he do it?
Well, he talks about one night when he was probably lying there in some small, wet, cold cave taking care of the sheep. He has a dream, And in this dream, God says to him, Patrick, it's time for you to go, time for you to go home. And Patrick wakes up, and he probably didn't believe it. He thought maybe it was his own imagination. But very soon thereafter, he has another dream. And in this dream, he says, God told him, Patrick, your ship is ready. And God tells him not only that the ship is ready, but exactly where it is and where he has to go. So Patrick wakes up, and he says, I can't ignore this. I've got to get going. So he sets off on this amazing journey, this escape across Ireland.
At this time, how would people think about dreaming and dreams? Would it have been a visionary kind of experience?
Well, you know, it was. When you read about classical literature, dreams were considered a sign from the gods, and the Christians took this over and saw very often as dreams being under the inspiration of God. In the ancient world, if you wanted to get healed, there were certain sanctuaries you could go to, and you would lie down, and you would have a dream, and then you would tell that dream to the priest the next morning, and then the priest would interpret it and devise some means of healing based on that dream. So dreams really were considered quite important by everybody in the classical world.
Mm. While Patrick was in Ireland as a slave, did his parents try to find him?
Well, we don't have any evidence of it, you know, but I really doubt it. I think that once somebody was taken to Ireland, they were mourned as if dead, because very often they probably were, or at least if they weren't dead, they had no hope at all of ever getting back to Britain.
Yeah, but he did.
But he did, yeah.
And he's a changed person, and he's 6 years older.
He is. He was a spoiled teenager when he was taken, and here he comes back. He's 21, 22 years old. And he has gone through an experience that I don't think any of us can even imagine. And so he has he's discovered his religious faith, but I think more than that, he's achieved a maturity that based on severe hardship.
Yeah. One can imagine how his family reacted upon seeing him.
Yeah, so, well, Patrick says that they were overjoyed to see Patrick back at the villa, and they couldn't believe it. Here was a son that they had thought was dead for 6 years, and back he walks through the gates of the villa one afternoon, and it must have been just amazing, and his parents were overjoyed, and I can imagine that he had feasting, and all the cousins and aunts and friends and neighbors for days and weeks would come by and want to hear the story of his escape, and they were just thrilled to have him back, and Patrick says they begged him, don't even consider ever going away anywhere away from where you are. Please stay with us.
Yeah. Had life in Britain changed in that period of 6 years, and what were his prospects upon returning home?
Well, it's a little bit of guesswork, but probably during the Romans withdrew from Britain sometime about 410. So it's possible that happened actually while Patrick was in Ireland. It happened sometime around that period. But just because the Roman government and the Roman legions withdrew from Britain, it didn't mean that Roman structure of government and society fell apart. Things probably continued very much as before, at least until the 550s, when you start getting the Germanic invasions of the Angles and Saxons and Jutes coming over. So I would imagine that all the time after Patrick came back, things were going on pretty much as before, and Patrick was expected to pick up his role. His father was a government official. It was probably thought that Patrick would do this. It was a hereditary office, and everybody assumed that he would just step back in, and everything would be fine.
Not to be. Patrick experienced what you might call a calling. He has another dream, another vision.
He does. He had, he said, three dreams, actually. He's back in Britain, and we don't know how long he was there before he started to have these dreams again. But in this first dream, he says he was sleeping, and there was, in this dream, he sees a man coming to him from Ireland, a man named Victor. Strangely enough, this man has a name. And he brings a letter to Patrick and hands it to Patrick, and Patrick looks at it, breaks open the seal, looks at the heading of the letter, and it says, The Voice of the Irish. So he starts to unroll this, and all of a sudden, he hears the sound of many, many Irish people crying to him out of this letter, and they're saying, Holy boy, come back to Ireland, we need you. And Holy Boy was probably a nickname which he picked up in Ireland. So he, you know, he hears this, and he wakes up, and he's, you know, he just can't believe it. He says he was very upset. But he doesn't decide to go back to Ireland then. It takes two more dreams before he finally gives in and decides to do it.
Yeah, and it's the third dream, isn't it, where he believes that it's not Victor who is calling him, it's not the Irish people who are calling him, but it is God.
Yes, oh yes. He it's a marvelous passage where he talks about he dreams that he sees the voice of God speaking inside of him and praying to God. It's an amazing amazing passage.
Yeah. So we really don't know how much time he spent back home in Britain before leaving to go back to Ireland.
No, we really don't. There's a chapter in the book I call The Missing Years, just for that reason. We don't really know exactly how long it was or exactly what he was doing, but I think you can make a pretty good supposition that he spent that time in training to be a Christian minister. He probably would have gone to one of the towns there in Britain. Later stories say that he went to Gaul, to modern-day France, to get training, and he may have. But I would guess probably he stuck closer to home. He attached himself to a bishop. There weren't any seminaries back then. And he studied Christianity. He learned how to be a minister. He would have eventually become a deacon himself, he says. And then finally he was ordained as a priest. And this would have taken several years at least for this to happen.
Mm-hmm. And then he became a bishop.
He did. And some people think that he became a bishop before he went to Ireland. I tend to think he went back to Ireland and then was later made a bishop. But it doesn't really matter. At some point he did become a bishop, yes.
Was he Ireland's first bishop?
No, he wasn't. That's another myth about Patrick. There was a man in the year 431, and we have a very good historical source, which says that the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, sent Palladius to Ireland as Ireland's first bishop. So Patrick was not the first bishop of Ireland at all. And there were these vague stories of previous missionaries, of priests, working mostly in the southern part of the island. And the stories that we have of Patrick, he never names any specific places, but at least we can guess that he was working in the north. That's what later stories say.
Hmm. Do the Irish remember Palladius today?
Well, you know, they do, but poor Palladius, he really suffered in later stories because people were trying to make Patrick look good, and they couldn't ignore the historical fact that Palladius was the first bishop. So what they did is they tried to downplay him. They say he came over, he spent just a little time, he got scared, and he went back to Britain, and then he died there, which is probably not fair. Palladius is barely remembered by anyone, and it's a shame. He was probably a very hard worker.
Yeah. Now, later, Patrick would have to defend himself to British bishops. Was that situation similar at all to the apparent difficulties that Palladius had?
Well, I don't know. I think what happened was later on that Patrick was, the way that Patrick had to operate in Ireland was so different than how bishops and bishops had to operate in the Roman world, that difference in his dealings with the kings and giving money to kings in order to operate, I think that's what got him in trouble. Palladius, we just don't know enough about him to really say what caused him that much trouble.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Philip Freeman is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of St. Patrick of Ireland, a biography. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with questions, comments. The phone number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Philip Freeman, is a professor of classics at Washington University in St. Louis. Well, you mentioned kings. We've got Celtic kings to deal with.
Yeah.
And Patrick was pretty successful, it seems, in dealing with them.
Well, he was. I think Patrick, he didn't have the best education, but I think he was a very smart guy, and he was very savvy, and he knew how to deal with Irish politics. there would have been maybe 150 different kings in Ireland, and Patrick had to get in good with one of them to begin his work. And so I can imagine him landing there in Ireland, probably, and there were already a few Christians there when he arrived. So he picked one of these places where there were some Christians. He went up to the king. He offered him some gifts just to get in good. And then he had to get permission to move from the king to move between different tribes. So I see him working very slowly, very carefully, moving from tribe to tribe, trying to minister to the Christians who were there already, and then whenever he had the opportunity, trying to preach the gospel to others, but trying to do it in a way that didn't get anybody upset, at least as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, besides the gifts and monies that were paid to the kings, what was in it for the kings?
Well, the kings would certainly enjoyed getting the gifts of Patrick, but I think there probably was a certain status, saying, you know, I've got this friend, or this person, Patrick, he's a Roman, and everybody in Ireland knew about Rome. I think there was probably a certain status in that, in having a relationship with a real Roman.
And the bishop is coming to dinner.
Yeah, oh, right? Exactly.
The kings had to be fair, but they had to be tough, too. Give us some sense of what these characters were like.
Well, being a king, I think, would have been a tough job because you had to be a judge, first of all, and you had to be fair with any disputes that were going on. And if you weren't fair, Irish legend says that you would lose your kingdom and that things would fall apart. But you also had to be tough enough to keep under control the Irish warriors, who were a very unruly lot, and they would think nothing about going out to an enemy and killing him and chopping off his head and hanging up the head on the wall of their house as a trophy. So a king had to be a man of many talents in order to deal with all these problems.
Yeah. You share in the book St. Patrick of Ireland a report of a Welshman named Gerald of the inauguration of a king. So not only, I mean, right from the get-go, a king is at least in this story, is bathed in blood.
Oh, yes. It's a fascinating story. Gerald was a Welsh churchman, comes along several centuries after Patrick, but he tells the story of being up in Donegal, up in the northwestern part of Ireland, and there's this ritual which takes place where a king is inaugurated, and what happens is, and I won't go into all the details here, but he has sex with a white horse, and then the white horse is chopped up into little bits, and put into a cooking pot with warm water, and then the king climbs in with it. It's kind of like a big jacuzzi, and then all the members of the tribe come by and eat the flesh of the horse, which is in the pot, and it's quite an interesting story.
What a story. Yikes. Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I assume that at that time the religion of Ireland was the Druids?
Yes, I think that the Druids we know were a big factor in Ireland, just like the Druids had been very important in Britain and in continental Europe before the Romans took over. I don't know for sure that the Druids were the beginning and the end of religion in Ireland, but they were certainly very important priests.
How did the Druids take to this new Christianity? Was there, you know, just intellectual curiosity, or was there hostility, or I'll hang up and listen.
Sure. It's really interesting. Patrick never actually mentions the word Druids in his letter, but we can use a little informed speculation and assume that the Druids weren't particularly happy about having this competition. We have later stories about Patrick battling the Druids, and I doubt that there was anything like that. We also have later stories about some Druids converting to Christianity, so I imagine a lot of them did have an intellectual curiosity. But I would bet that Patrick was seen mostly, especially as time went on, as competition, especially when he started converting members of the sons and daughters of kings.
Hmm. Now, the Druids, What can you tell us about what they might have believed in?
Well, the Druids, we have some very good records of the Druids in modern-day France, in Gaul, before the Roman takeover. And the things that come up the most are the ones which are most spectacular, such as human sacrifice. And that was certainly a part. We can't ignore that there really was human sacrifice among the Druids. But I think Celtic religion consisted of a lot more than that. There's a lot of what we call animal magic in Celtic religion. They used the flights of birds to interpret the future. Well, the Greeks and Romans did that too. But and there were offerings put into water at springs that people would offer in order to get healed. Little wooden carvings. They're actually quite beautiful. We can only assume that the religion of the Druids in Gaul was something like the religion of the Druids in Ireland.
Yeah. Were there many gods that existed in the Druid belief?
Oh, yes, there were. It was very much like Greece and Rome. Everybody studied classical mythology in high school, and there's a different god for every function. And that seems to have been the way it was in the ancient Celtic world and in Ireland. We know about a number of different gods. Lugos is the most famous. He turns into Lug in Old Irish and is celebrated in Lugnasa, Dancing with Lugnasa, is from that. So, but there were a lot of different gods, some of them male, some of them female. The Druids, by the way, most people don't realize this, but of the individual Druids that we know about from ancient times, most of them were actually women. It would seem to have been an equal opportunity kind of religion.
Hmm. Did they believe in life after death?
Oh, they certainly did. They believed in reincarnation. And this is fascinating. It's very much like reincarnation as it develops in Hinduism in India. They believed in that people would die and that they would be reborn. Sometimes there seems to be a kind of a waiting period in limbo until people are reborn. But that's a belief that comes up all throughout the Celtic world, of that when somebody dies, they will be reborn.
Hmm. Did the Druid beliefs influence Christianity in Ireland?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. There are people, and some very smart people, who think that Irish Christianity, early Irish Christianity, was a blending of the ancient Druid ways and Christianity. I tend to think that that's not really true. I certainly think that Patrick, like other early Christian missionaries and early Christian ministers, adopted native beliefs as much as possible in order to make Christianity easier for people to believe. But I don't really see an amalgamation of Druidism and Christianity in early Irish Christianity. There certainly was a blending. You can look at stories of people like St. Bridget, who was a real person who lived just a little bit after Patrick. And you look at stories about her, and you can see the many similarities to Celtic mythology. So there was some borrowing and some blending. But how much it was, it's just really hard to say.
Hmm. Going back to royalty, Ireland had queens as well. Were there powerful queens in Ireland at the time Patrick was trying to convert the Irish?
Well, we don't hear about queens per se, I mean, at least from Patrick's letters. In Irish literature, we have some wonderfully strong women figures. Meddhav or Maeve was a great queen in the epic Toyn. In more real Ireland, as shown in the Irish laws, women had certain rights to divorce and to child support and things like that. But it was not a society of equality, I don't think, by any means. It was a tough life for women.
Hmm. Now, Patrick apparently had appealed greatly to women. What was his relationship to women in Ireland? Why were they drawn to him?
Well, it's really interesting. Again and again in Patrick's letters, he talks about his concern for the women, and the slave women keep coming up all over the place, but not just slave women. He talks about daughters of kings, and it seems that women were drawn to Patrick's Christianity more than the men. And this really isn't unusual when you read stories about Christianity in the Roman world in the first and second century. This is often the case, that the women were more receptive to Christianity than the men. And Patrick may have taken advantage of this and preached more to women, figuring that if he could win the women over to Christianity, then he would win the children over and eventually the whole household.
Hmm. Was Patrick celibate?
Well, he certainly preached celibacy. He encouraged any of his Christian converts who wanted to, and he didn't require it or anything like that. But he said that certain people are called to be celibate. I can't imagine that Patrick would encourage people to do that unless he did it himself. He never mentions having a wife. So I would think he was celibate himself.
Hmm, interesting. Let's talk with a caller. The caller that we talked with just a couple minutes ago has called back. She's got another question.
Sure.
Line one, Urbana, go ahead.
Oh, hi, yes. I'm a big mystery reader, and there is a author called Peter Tremaine, which is a pseudonym for another name. He's an Irish scholar.
Oh.
And his main female detective character is a woman, and she is a priest of the Irish. She's a Christian priest of the Irish. And it's a very charming series. And he maintained that Irish women had an enormous amount of equality in Ireland, that rape was considered a heinous crime, that they had all the rights, and compared to the rest of the world, that the Irish women were quite independent and quite equal to their male counterparts. And that, let's see, he writes this mystery around the 1670s.
Yeah.
And he claims that there would be houses of convents and of monasteries, and that celibacy was not required as it was in the 670s, as it was in Rome, and that priests often married, and the priestesses often married as well. And it was very interesting. So, you know, for anybody who's curious about that, and he maintains, you know, that it is based on Irish scholarship. So for what it's worth, I thought I would just pass that along. Peter Tremaine.
I think a lot of it actually is true. The fact that, rape, for instance, there were Irish laws against rape which were severe. Sexual relations, marriage in early Ireland in general, granted a great deal of authority and rights to women. And divorce, for example. This is something the church struggled against in Ireland for a long time. In ancient Ireland, a woman could divorce her husband if he beat her, and it says very frankly, if he became too fat for sexual intercourse, she could divorce her husband. And if her husband couldn't get her pregnant, she could go to another man, he could get her pregnant, and then her husband would have to raise that child. So there were a lot of rights. I think the idea of early Ireland as being a place of equality for women is perhaps overstated. Although we do have some great examples of people like Bridget, who I mentioned before, who was a great leader of the church. But even for her to establish a church, she had to go find a priest, at least to use as a front man, to do this. But I think that there are some great examples of very strong and very powerful women. But I don't know of any good solid instances of women being priests in early Ireland, although they certainly had positions of power in the church.
Hmm. We've got another caller. I'm sorry to say we're not going to be able to take your call this afternoon to the caller on line two in Western Champaign, because we're out of time here. But to wrap up, Professor Freeman, what do you think Patrick's greatest contribution to Irish history and culture was?
Well, he brought Christianity to much of Ireland, but he also, along with Christianity, brought writing and literature, which the Irish took to very fast, and they became great scholars.
Mm. Very interesting. What a fascinating story. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Philip Freeman has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a professor of classics at Washington University in St. Louis. He's written a biography of Patrick called St. Patrick of Ireland. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, futures in the wheat pit finished the day like this, up 19.5 cents in that nearby May contract at 392 on the high for the day, the low at 373, a settlement price there at 391.5. Once again, the nearby May wheat up 19.5 cents, and the rest of the floor was up nearly as much as well. July contract 18.5 higher at 394.5 on the high, the low at 376.5, a settlement price for that July 18.5 cents higher at 394 for the day. September contract in the wheat pit, 396 the high, the low at 381.5, a settlement price at 396, up on its high at 15.75 higher, and the December wheat, 405 the high, low at 389.5, a settlement price at 404.5, up 15.5 cents. The March wheat, 406 the high, the low at 391.5, a settlement price at 406, up 14.5 on the day. May corn at 309.25 for the high, the low at 303.25, a settlement price 308.25, it managed a 3 cent rally for the day. July futures up 2.5. At a high today of 313.25, July corn 307 on the low, a settlement price at 312. Once again, it finished 2.5 cents higher. September futures 305.5 high, low at $3.25 even, settled 304.75, up 2.75. And the December corn 301 high, low at 296.25, a settlement price $3 even, a penny and a half higher. March futures $3.50 settlement price there was up to, had a high today of 301.5, a low at 296.5. May futures in the corn pit 302.25, the high, the low at 298.25, and the settlement price for that 05 new crop May contract at 302.25, up 2.5 cents. New July at 302.5 on the high, the low at 299.75, settled 302.5, up 2.5, and the December, 2 years out, the 2005 contract, 268.5 the high, the low at 266.5, a settlement price there on the low at 266.5. That December contract, the only loser in the corn pit for the day, it was a penny and a half lower. May oats, 167 the high, the low at 161.5, a settlement price at 166.75, up 4.75. And July oats, 172 for the high, the low at 166.25, a settlement price 170.75, it finished 4.75 higher. From the soy complex now, another good day in the nearby bean contracts, but the deferreds were losers. May futures in the bean pit, $9.99, not quite $10 for the day. For the May, on the high, the low at $9.82, a settlement price at $9.94. It finished a nickel higher. July, $9.92, the high, the low at $9.73, a settlement price at $9.83.5. And they finished up 4.75. August beans, 942 the high, the low at 925, a settlement price at 932.5, up a penny and a half. It's probably important to note that those nearby contracts all traded on both sides of unchanged for the day. The September soybeans down, 846 the high, the low at 835, a settlement price 839. They were down two. The Novembers, 759 the high, the low at 750, settled a nickel above that at 755, down a penny and 3/4. And the Januaries, 756 the high, the low at 750, settled 753, down 3. The March soybeans, 748 on the high, the low at 745, a settlement price there, 746. They were a penny and a half lower. The May bean meal, 307 high, low at $3 even, or at 300 even, and a settlement price at 304.90. They were up 280. July bean meal at 304.40 on the high, the low at 298. A settlement price at 302.40, up 260. The May bean oil, 33.85 the high, the low at 33.20. A settlement price at 33.39, down 18. And July oil, 33.69 the high, the low at 33.08. A settlement price at 33.32, and they finished down 18 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Today was a lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, 90.65 the high, 90.15 the low, 90.50 the settlement, that unchanged. April, 90.25 the high, 87.65 the low, 87.92.5 the settlement, that down 140. May, 88.75 the high, 86 even the low, 86.32.5 the settlement, that down 177.5. August, 89.30 the high, 87.10 the low, 87.50 the settlement, that down 145. March, live cattle, 87.10 the high, 86.95 the low, the settlement, 86.95, that up 25. April, 83.40 the high, 81.30 the low, 81.97 and a half the settlement, that down 65. June, 78 even the high, 76.60 the low, 77 even the settlement, that down 35. August, 75.40 the high, 74.45 the low, 74.85 the settlement, that down 25. April lean hog, 65.65 the high, 63.60 the low, 64.07 and a half the settlement, that down 122 and a half. May, 65.40 the high, 64.15 the low, 64.70 the settlement, that down 57 and a half. June, 70.70 the high, 68.97 and a half the low, 69.40 the settlement, that down 105. July lean hog, 66.47 and a half the high, 65.30 the low, the settlement 66.07 and a half, that down 40. March bellies, 99.80 the high, 98.80 the low, 99.80 the settlement, that up 120. May bellies, 98.40 the high, 96.80 the low, 98.07 and a half the settlement, that up 42 and a half. The Dow is up 120 points at 10,305. The NASDAQ is 31 points higher at 1974. The S&P 500 up 13 points at 1124.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, with foods from around the world. Currently, World Harvest is featuring foods from India, including Indian sweets, snacks, paratha, and curries, with taste samplings available. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Juliet Kaufman from Iowa City, Iowa writes, Dear Dr. Science, today I looked in my appointment book and found that I had to be in two places at once. Does this ever happen to you?
Usually at least twice a day. Bilocation's a simple matter once you've laid the temporal groundwork. Of course, nowadays, having a split personality is not unusual, but knowing how to send each half to a different location, conduct business, and then reconvene to compare notes, well, that takes some doing. I've never had a problem fragmenting my personality, but it wasn't until I discovered crazy glue that I was able to achieve integration again. Now I can be two places at once if my appointments call for it, or just plain old me back at the lab. Isn't that right, Doctor? You bet.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Next Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. To order the Dr. Science Get Smart Kit with new CD screensaver for PCs and a master's degree mouse pad, $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM.